This is Alan Beller, the chair of the Due Process Oversight Committee. This is a public meeting of the committee, the purpose of which is to discuss the two letters that the chair of the DPOC has received regarding the lease term agenda decision. They are published on our website, and the paper prepared by foundation staff regarding those letters is also published on the website. We're going to discuss that paper and those letters. Secondly, we are going to discuss the potential revisions to the due process handbook regarding agenda decisions. The foundation staff paper regarding those potential revisions is also published on the website. We are Quorate. I think we have apologies from Vinod Raj, and everyone else from the committee is present. And I'm going to turn this over in the first instance to Richard Thorpe to discuss the paper and the subject of the two letters.
Yes, good Richard. Afternoon. Good afternoon. Good morning, everybody. You have before you Agenda Paper 1, which sets out the background to the two complaints we've received and the process we have followed. And as you know, the process we follow is set out in the Due Process Handbook in paragraphs 8.3 and following. So the two letters, one from the French preparers, Actio, AFEP and MEDEF, and one from the UK Hunder Group, have both been posted to the website. You have before you a paper from the technical staff describing there is an assessment of those two complaints, and a covering paper from the foundation staff from me, which sets out our views on the technical staff's paper. So the two letters both have views about the due process surrounding agenda decisions as it currently stands, and ask whether the current simple majority expectation on agenda decision from the IFS Interpretations Committee, whether that is appropriate. In addition, the letter from the Hunder Group has some concerns about the way that the staff paper was for discussion on that was drafted and whether it complied with due process requirements. Following that paper, you have Agenda Paper 1A from the technical staff, which sets out the process that has been followed and explains the paper that had been drafted, and you also have received copies of the actual staff paper that went to the committee, which is the subject of the Hunder Group letter. I've been through those papers, and I'm confident that the assertion made by the technical staff is correct, is valid, that the underlying staff paper was appropriate for the needs of the committee. In particular, it didn't offer any recommendations on this particular issue and allowed the committee room to make a decision, but it set out very clearly the arguments that had been put forward from commenters and the way that those had been addressed. So the questions for you that we've set out in paragraph 7, first, do you agree that the due process requirements have been met and that we should write to the complainants setting that out? Do you authorise the chair of the committee to respond to the complainants through that letter? And do you agree that we should go ahead with publishing the agenda decision? And just to remind you that agenda paper 2 here, which we'll be considering next, actually sets out how the due process handbook might be amended to address issues around agenda decisions in the future, but that those proposals would not affect this particular case.
Thank you, Richard. Sue Hans, anything you want to add to that? I would make only, I guess, one point, emphasizing one thing that the papers you have in front of you talk about, which is this question of sort of disproportionality of space or in terms of the commenters versus the staff analysis. The board, when they standard setting and the interpretations committee, the IFRIC, when they do agenda decisions, as you know, there are comment periods. And in this case, we received, I think it was 33 comment letters regarding the lease term agenda decision. Those comments are all posted on our website and are publicly available. More importantly, those comments, for this purpose, those comments are available to and part of the materials that are available to the Interpretations Committee in their raw form in thinking about the interpretations, the exposure draft, the tentative decision in this case, and reactions. So the technical due process has never involved either at the board level or at the IFRIC level trying to make complete summaries of comment letters. It is expected that board and committee members will review the actual raw letters as part of their preparations for the discussion. And so I think it's important to take that background in effect when you look at the papers and evaluate the question about, well, you know, there was only X percent of the paper was taken up with discussing the comments and Y percent was taken up discussing the letters. The X percent is, in fact, very, very much more substantial because the comments themselves are available. With that, I guess open to the committee, any comments, questions that we ought to discuss answering the questions that this paper puts forth for you in number 7, which I think are the right questions for the committee.
Alan, it's Sheila. I have one question. Has the Interpretations Committee been made aware of these letters, and particularly
yes,
the 100 group, which, you know, alleges certain that due process was not followed? And if the committee has been made aware of it, can they give us any assurance that the way the staff paper was prepared, for example, was not leading to a preferred answer, that they were able, with all the other information that they had and all the comment letters, to arrive at an opinion, at their opinions objectively?
Okay. To answer your first question, the committee was made aware of the letters. They were, the full text of the letters was specifically provided to the committee. As to the second part, I'm going to ask Sue to provide what I think are the committee's, the interpretation committee's views.
We haven't gone back and formally asked them that question, Sheila, but I can say that during the discussion at the committee, which was quite a long discussion, it was about 2 hours long, so a very thorough discussion compared with actually what is standard for the re-deliberations on tentative agenda decisions, there was quite a bit of the conversation that was about the content of the letters. So in the discussion itself, that was very much highlighted, and there was quite a lot of additional points raised by some of the committee members about what they'd also heard and discussions with preparers, etc., in the market. So I can't answer your specific question, but I do know that in the discussion itself, it certainly wasn't limited to the analysis that the staff had provided in the summary to the committee. It was apparent committee members had read the letters.
So I had a much broader perspective on the issue than just the staff paper. Good, thank you.
Yeah. Which is typical of the committee. They do read the letters.
Yeah. Sheila, I can't. It's Alan. I will just supplement. Henry was, at my request, I think it was Henry, kind enough to send me a link to the, or Sam, to a link to the recording of the call. And I can't say I listened to the whole 2 hours, but I did listen to parts of it. And what I listened to, I think amply supports what Sue said, that there is a discussion that certainly goes beyond the four corners of the paper and that does take into account the comments themselves.
Good. Thank you.
And then there is a reference in the letter from the 100 group to the fact that this is not the first instance when the decision of the district changed the meaning of a standard. My understanding is that we don't change the meaning of a standard through an interpretation, but could we get some comment from staff on that?
Yeah, I think the staff paper does mention that. Richard, am I correct?
Yes, it does. Petrina can elaborate.
Yes, so just to help you, but what we understand that reference in the 100 group letter is to a particular agenda decision that was published in September 2017 and was related to interest and penalties that are related to income taxes. Now I think when the 100 group refers to if it changed the meaning of a standard, I probably relate that to stakeholders' understanding of how to read the requirements. So I think that particular decision on interest and penalties, by the way, interestingly, only said, didn't reach in that case, by the way, a very sort of what I might say firm conclusion on exactly what an answer is. It actually just set out and said entities would, consider whether interest and penalties meet the definition of income tax in IAS 12. If so, you apply it. So it was very much a sort of guide to applying our requirements. But I think that what the 100 group letter is referring to in that case, as I say, is not a change of the requirements, but a change to stakeholders' understanding of how to read the requirements.
And you said this is addressed.
It's paragraph
33
of the staff letter. Yeah.
Sorry, Alan. I do have a question. It's Teresa here. Maybe after you've clarified what's just been said.
So maybe just to finish on this point, the 34 does not say, this paper doesn't discuss further, and it put that in context of the fact that it is published more than 2 years ago. But could you just clarify my understanding that a decision is not supposed to change the meaning of the standard?
That's correct.
Which is what I have.
That is correct.
And that in no instance, in this one, nor in the previous one,
yes,
the staff considered that there was a change in the meaning of the standard.
Don't believe there was a change in the meaning of the standard, because really all that agenda decision did was remind people they needed to read and meet the definition. But I think in the same way that the discussion here links into the second paper, in the sense that some of the comments made about simple majority are addressed in the due process handbook. One of the things we are proposing to strengthen in the due process handbook when we put it out for comment was confirming that agenda decisions cannot change or add to the existing requirements. So that's another area that we want to make even more clear through the due process handbook.
Yeah. Michelle, I think there's a... I'm not making a technical comment at all. I'm not capable and I'm not supposed to, but just a logical comment. It seems to me that in the case of most agenda decisions, if they get to the point of being a question to the Interpretations Committee, it's a serious question. There's some issue about interpretation of a standard. There's a decision not to engage in standard setting. There is almost, by definition, some preparer out there somewhere or some group that has raised the question such that almost by virtue of its existence, the agenda decision is going to be interpreted as something that somebody was doing was following an accounting policy, not that it was an error, but an accounting policy that might be changed as a result of the agenda decision. And so the agenda decision that's cited in the letter may be one that was particularly close or controversial or raised sharper issues, but that an agenda decision would lead to some stakeholders to engage in a change in accounting policy is in fact what the process is all about, in a sense.
I had a question.
Thank you, Alan.
Teresa?
Thank you. Sorry. Yes, thank you. Thank you, everyone. My question is
this, Teresa, can you speak up or get closer to the mic or something?
Okay. All right. Hi. Is that better?
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. My question is simply to ask whether these complaints are the first time that the meaning of what constitutes an agenda decision, and in particular the clarification that an agenda decision is not required is the first time it's being dealt with. Is the first time that what is an agenda, what the meaning of agenda
I can't hear
done.
Teresa. It's garbled.
We can't hear either of you. It's breaking up.
Sorry?
You're breaking up.
Hello?
So we can't quite hear you, Teresa. You're breaking up on the line.
I can hear you guys very clearly. Maybe I'll try another. I'll dial back in. Is that okay?
Sure.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes,
hello?
Please.
Okay, I'll go back in.
Okay, while Teresa is dialing back in, any other questions, comments?
Just to summarize at high, very high level, so we have two letters. These letters make allegation about a due process not being followed, and we just heard that, especially around the way the staff presented the views of the letters. That's the main point, right? Is there any other point on the due process that you think raised? And then there is a series of other comments that are really related to process, basically, and what would be an improvement in the process, challenge of the second existing process, which is a separate issue.
That's the way I read the letter.
But on the first point, which is Sheila's question, we satisfied that basically there is only one issue raised, which is the one around the communication to the group, and Sue presented a extensive discussion around that.
Right.
There is no other points around the actual process.
Right. I guess I would unpack it slightly, Michelle, into I think that as a precise matter of due process, the way in
Hello,
which the
I'm
staff...
back on. Is it...
Okay, I'm sorry, Teresa, can you hang on 1 second and then we'll take your question. I think the particular way in which the staff presents a particular issue is not directly addressed in the due process handbook.
That's right.
I think notwithstanding that Sheila's question goes to, and I think Sue's answer and my answer go to, and the technical staff paper goes to, was the staff's presentation fair and balanced, for lack of a better set of terms?
That's the question.
And I think the staff has concluded, and Sue, as the chair of the interpretations committee, has weighed in, and I've weighed in based on a partial reading of listening to the recording, that yes, the staff's position was fair and balanced. And so that's the overarching purpose of due process. It's not the specific due process step-by-step issue. So that's point one. Point two, the step-by-step due process issues in the case of this agenda decision have been followed. So I think that's the way to kind of think about the question and the answer.
Okay, thank you.
Teresa?
Is the line better?
Let's try. Hello? Give us your questions, please.
Okay. My question is whether the meaning of what constitutes an agenda decision has ever been discussed by either the board or this committee in its, you know, with its previous constituent, and is anything which is which we are proposing now is materially inconsistent with the way that the board or this committee had determined it before.
I think the answer is there has not been, to my knowledge, a complaint on this issue before. I think it is fair to say that the Interpretations Committee has, in its prior activities, viewed the agenda decision purpose as consistent, certainly not inconsistent with, and I think perfectly consistent with what's been followed at this point. First and foremost, it represents a decision that standard setting will not be undertaken. And in recent years, the Interpretations Committee has gone on to add explanatory material to its agenda decision in some cases, and I guess I would say in an increasing number of cases, so that it's now become a pretty consistent practice. Explanatory material, the purpose of which is to explain the thinking behind why agenda decisions don't need to be undertaken and why the standard as it is currently drafted is adequate for the purpose. The Due Process Oversight Committee has been made aware in recent years of the, let me go back a step. The Due Process Oversight Committee has, certainly to my knowledge, always understood the principal purpose of the agenda decision, to communicate that there will not be standard setting. And in recent years, the Interpretation Committee practice of adding explanatory material has been brought to the attention of the Due Process Oversight Committee. And I think the committee as an institution is certainly aware that that's developed into a more common process. One of the reasons that agenda decisions is such a big part of the revision process that we're going to turn to later in today's call is so that the committee can, I think, for the first time, make more clear on the face of the handbook what is going on with these decisions. But I think it's an absolutely correct statement to say that what's going on in this decision is completely consistent with prior practice, and there's no real departure in the case of this decision. Anybody?
Okay.
Wanna?
Thank you. Thank you, Alan. Thank you. And then
I'm getting nods around the table that suggests that I haven't completely bollocked that up.
All right. Thank you. That's good to know. That's good to know. Thank you.
Anything else?
Not from me, Alan. Thank you.
Okay. Is the committee prepared to let me call the questions, the three questions? I think they're kind of all of a piece, and I would ask that we, unless somebody wants to talk about them separately, the three questions in paragraph 7 of this paper. Does the DPOC agree that the existing due process requirements have been met, and that the letter to the complainant should explain this? Does the DPOC authorize the chair to respond to the complaints? And in that response, we will mention the ongoing review, as I just did, and how it relates to at least one of the issues raised in the letter, Michelle's second issue. And does the DPOC agree that we should go ahead and publish this agenda decision? We had, as the paper to you mentioned, I had, at the recommendation of the staff, asked that publication be delayed until we could address the letters on this call. I think we are now in a position to release this decision and let it go into effect. So do the members of the committee agree with this? And I guess since it's a phone meeting, what I would ask is, does anyone disagree with this? Because I will take silence as we're all good. Everybody's okay?
Yes. Yep.
Yes.
Good. So
I fully agree. I just wanted to add something. Just in terms of the letter, the second point, I imagine the first of the letter is that as of today we have a process that we believe is fit for purpose. This process has been followed based on the
diligence.
But beyond that, we are actually looking at ways.
We are actually, yes, that's the second.
Two points will be made clear.
Yes. Yeah, we will specifically address the second point.
Yeah,
okay.
I would also like to just say, Alan, I would just also like to say that I want to thank the staff for the support that was pulled together. It was very comprehensive, and I really... really supported the decisions we just made. It was very good.
Alan,
thank
I
you,
second
Larry.
That
I,
motion.
I completely agree as well. I thank both the people in the room and the people outside the room if we could make sure they know of our appreciation for the good work that's been done on this.
But also our appreciation for the writers of the letters to actually be interested in our work.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. Yeah, I agree. And we will make that point. Shall we turn to the second paper, the second set of questions, which are the potential revisions to the handbook? I'm going to ask Sam Prestige, if he would prendre la parole and lead us through this.
Well, thank you very much, Alan. So as the committee is aware, in October of 2019, you discussed an overview of the comments received relating to agenda decisions in response to the proposed amendments to the handbook. As Alan mentioned, Agenda Paper 2 provides the DPOC with recommendations following the DPOC's discussion at that October meeting. The paper focuses on the following three areas. Firstly, improving the description of agenda decisions in the handbook, whether to enhance the due process procedures for agenda decisions, and whether to retain the proposal relating to board agenda decisions. In addition, I will also address the question of re-exposure. So I will start with improving the description of agenda decisions. The exposure draft sought to explain with greater clarity the objective and nature of explanatory material in an agenda decision. Many responses focused on the description of the status of agenda decisions, and respondents said the phrase helpful, informative, and persuasive that was retained as part of the description could give the impression that explanatory material is optional and can be ignored, which could be detrimental to consistent application. Now, forgive me if I'm going over old ground and what we've already discussed in the context of the letters, but this really is the crux of the matter. And that is that agenda decisions often explain how to apply the existing principles and requirements in IFRS standards, and an entity must determine whether the transactional fact pattern described in an agenda decision is applicable to it. If that is the case, the entity needs to apply the accounting specified in the agenda decision, because that is what IFRS standards require. The authority of agenda decisions is derived from the standards themselves. The staff think it is important that the wording in the handbook explaining the nature of agenda decisions avoids any impression that agenda decisions can be ignored when the transaction or fact pattern described is applicable to an entity. Now looking at another area of the description of agenda decisions, which concerns new information. It was proposed that the handbook should explain that agenda decisions often result in explanatory material that provides new information that was not otherwise available and could not otherwise reasonably have been expected to be obtained. Because of this, an entity might determine that it needs to change an accounting policy as a result of an agenda decision. There were respondents that said the reference in the proposals to new information is inconsistent with stating that agenda decisions do not add or change the requirements in IFRS standards. One of the objectives of the additional clarity proposed has been to explain that a change resulting from an agenda decision is often not the correction of an error. The proposed wording referring to new information was based on IAS 8's description of such a correction. Respondents' comments indicate that the proposed wording is confusing. The staff therefore suggest changing it to say that an agenda decision often provides additional insights about the application of existing IFRS standards, as this better captures the benefits of an agenda decision in aiding an entity's understanding of how to apply the standards. Another aspect of the description of agenda decision refers to sufficient time and the proposed amendments to the handbook, highlighting the board's view that an entity is expected to be entitled to sufficient time to make the determination of whether to make an accounting policy change as a result of an agenda decision and implement that change. There were respondents that suggested including some of the wording contained in the article written by Sue Lloyd on the subject. The staff recommend adding a sentence to the handbook regarding sufficient time to include the principle that is set out in paragraph 21 of Agenda Paper 2. So, Alan, at this point, I'll pause and ask the DPOC if it agrees with the proposed drafting that is set out in Appendix A of the paper relating to an improved description of agenda decisions.
Sam, as you know, I forwarded some comments to just reinforce really the points that you've made really try to underline that the if the fact pattern is applicable to an entity that the impact of the agenda decision is effectively mandatory on the entity in order to comply with IFRS standards.
Hi, this is Guillermo. I agree with what Larry said, specifically in paragraph 8 or numeral 8.5 in Appendix A. I think it is not clear that the entity must follow the interpretations committee decision. So I think stronger wording is needed in 8.5 to make sure that it is a mandatory requirement.
Okay. I think that certainly Larry's drafting suggestion we've got, as I said, I don't think we want to do drafting at this meeting, but I think the point is taken that I guess I would say there are three things to kind of come together in this set of issues that Sam has addressed. One is to make the handbook reflect the board's decision in IAS 8 an agenda decision cannot change the standards. Secondly, to further the important purpose that agenda decisions are intended to at the highest level further, which is consistent application of IFRS. And that's the point that I think Larry and Guillermo are directly addressing here, agenda decision. In order to be in compliance with IFRS, you have to be in compliance with the agenda decision. And thirdly, depending on the circumstances, it may take more than a nanosecond to consider an accounting policy and change an accounting policy, and the agenda, the handbook, in effect, recognizes the laws of physics, and also the suggestion of the board that sufficient time is required. But that sufficient time is that which is sufficient and not more. They have to be done expeditiously. This is not a grace period. This is sufficient time to actually implement something that has to be implemented. I think those are the three fundamental thoughts that are embodied in here. And as to Guillermo and Larry's comments, which are directly to the second point, I think we will get that right in the drafting, but I think the substance is agreed to. But my sense is that the committee agrees to the substance.
Yeah, Len, I would echo that. I think, you know, the point that were made that, you know, once the same, it should be applied, basically. There's an optionality around that.
Right.
And on, you know, on the concept of sufficient time, it's interesting because you could think about it the other way around, which is, rather than think it should be as soon as, you know, possible or as soon as, so I don't know how, you know, which one of the two concepts which lead to the same thing would actually be most effective in communicating a urgency around the implementation.
My own view is that sufficient time does mean as soon as practicable, if you will.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the drafting says, but we can look at that too. I mean, this is, as I said, this is not a grace period.
You know, some sort of acknowledgement that if the timing is such that, you know, an agenda decision comes down just as an entity is about to release its financial statement, obviously, you know, that puts the entity in a tough position, and they simply may not have the time to change the accounting. But some acknowledgement that a change is expected would probably be the right answer, and it would also have the effect of helping to ensure that the entity is timely in making whatever changes are necessary in order to comply with an agenda decision. And it would also have the benefit, I think, of alerting the user community that something is going to change, so that there isn't, you know, a surprise. I think it would be in the best interest of all concerned preparers and users if we sort of reminded preparers to if you run into that situation where an agenda decision is reached just as you're about to release earnings or about to release financial statements, that this agenda decision may well be applicable, and the company is going to need to look into it and disclose whatever it is that they can disclose at the time, reasonably disclose.
I think just on the disclosure front, we already have sort of general disclosure requirements around changes in accounting policy, etc., in IAS 8. So I think that so far, at least from looking at the staff and nodding at me, from a staff perspective, I think the thinking has been that we can rely on those disclosure requirements that already exist and would cover these types of circumstances, rather than starting to put disclosure requirements into the due process handbook.
Yeah,
maybe a reference to. I'm sorry, I was saying if that. Go ahead.
Larry, yes. Hang on a second. Let me see. Larry or Henry?
I'm sorry. I was only just going to add also that Sue's article touches on this point in this context as well about those requirements in ISA. So it's one of the sort of features touched on.
Yeah, I think we can, without drafting our own sufficient time requirements, we could probably make a reference of some sort that to IAS 8 that picks that up.
That's good.
I think we have to be careful. The only thing I think we have to be careful about is quote unquote effective dates, because that's not what we're doing here. To go back to the first point, we're not changing standards, and so we don't have effective dates, and that's kind of the starting point for the quandary that we've been trying to work our way through in terms of how to describe sufficient time. But Larry, I think your point is right. Clarity and putting users on, I'm sorry, putting preparers on notice is something that's important.
Alan, and what's your consensus? Would this be recognized as an error? Is there a scenario where it could be?
I think there are, I'll give you my own view, which is I think there are two issues, which is the most important issue is we're not saying there's never an error. We're saying that there can be a change in accounting policy as a result of an agenda decision that is not the correction of an error,
right.
That is a change in accounting policy. That does not mean that there is no situation where, as a result of an agenda decision, a preparer or its auditors or its regulators will conclude that there was an error.
Right.
It's just that they're not congruent boxes.
No,
you can change accounting policy as a result of an agenda decision and not have it be an error.
If you want to know whether or not there is an error, where do you go?
It's a judgment that's already applied by the profession, basically, and by the securities regulators. I think the one thing that we are sort of thinking from a technical perspective is that there could be situations where somebody sends us a question which is just so obviously a misreading of the standard. We wouldn't want them to hide behind an agenda decision to say, you know, this is my cover for any question of an error. I think if we ever had that situation, we could put wording in an agenda decision that would give a very clear direction that it was clear that this was not what the standard said. Now, usually we're very, very careful not to use those words, because if we say that, that implies an error. But if we have a situation where, for example, what I'm in the back of my mind worried about is we don't want to create a situation where the way to ensure you can never have an error is to send it via the interpretation on the way to the regulator, would be to actually be more blunt in the agenda decision to have the opposite effect.
But that's why it's probably be helpful to have somewhere a reference that someone could use to decide, or do you consider that's left?
I think we'd do it in the wording of the agenda decision at the time. So I think if we were to, for argument's sake, put in an agenda decision, it is clearly required by the standards that you do A, B, and C. If you'd done X, Y, and Z, by conclusion, you would be steering towards an accounting error. So I think we still have that, but that's different to our usual situation.
Right. But the articulation between error and agenda decision?
It's an IAS 8.
It's an IAS 8 issue.
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe we should say that. Specific.
Say in accordance with IAS 8. We can have a cross-reference for what an accounting error is.
Yeah. IAS 8 defines what is a correction
of
an error.
We could have a cross-reference.
Yeah.
I mean, it's clear in the accounting literature what a quote-unquote error is. I don't think I want to put that back in the due process handbook.
No, but
can we refer to it? And I can tell you from any conversations with preparers and auditors and regulators, it's a little bit you know it when you see it. There are some things that are changes that are not errors. There are other things that are changes that are errors. And
but at least we have a framework.
Yeah, but there is a framework, and we can refer to it.
Uh-oh.
Teresa or Sheila? Somebody's breaking up. I'm sorry, somebody's breaking up. That's the reason I can't tell.
Oh, God, it's great. Alan, it's Teresa. Can you see that I can... Hello?
Yeah, are you on a speaker?
No, I'm not. I'm not.
That's now clear. Go ahead. Yes, I can now.
Thank you. Thank you. In Appendix A, we introduce a concept of amended tentative agenda decision, which is not apparent as to its meaning on the on the sort of 1.5 page. Does that need to be explained better?
Is that in 8.2b, Teresa?
Yes, yes, yes. And yeah, I thought that if you have explanatory material, then it may find its way to a tentative agenda decision, which is subject to approval. But I don't think that interpretation, which is my own, is actually consistent if you read the other paragraphs. So I think that the 8.2b just came out with an amended tentative agenda decision, which is not explained in this text, but it may be in other parts of the handbook. And if that were the case, then I apologize for not having checked it.
Okay, we'll make that more clear. I think all that this is flagging is the fact that there could be an occasion where the interpretation committee changes its sort of proposed wording to such an extent they decide that re-exposure would be appropriate before finalising, and it's just not very clear from what we've got here, so we can look at the wording again.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Sue.
Any other comments, questions? Ma'am, shall we go on?
Yeah, indeed. Thank you very much, Alan. So I'll move on to another aspect, which is the due process associated with agenda decisions. So the DPOC proposed no change to the due process relating to agenda decisions in the exposure draft, and accordingly did not ask a question specifically in the exposure draft. Nonetheless, respondents commented on the due process and suggested changes. There were respondents that commented, as we've already discussed, on the simple majority vote required by the Interpretations Committee to publish an agenda decision with explanatory material. So with the DPOC essentially agreeing that the handbook needs to be more explicit about how agenda decisions need to be applied, the staff also recommend enhancing the due process for publishing an agenda decision. And we think that this leaves two logical options for the DPOC to consider regarding changing the voting requirements specifically to publishing an agenda decision. In the context of finalising an agenda decision, the DPOC could, in light of those comments received, consider requiring a supermajority vote of the Interpretation Committee members present before publishing an agenda decision. However, it is our recommendation that the DPOC enhance due process by formally involving the board in the process of publishing an agenda decision. We think that such involvement would enable the board, as the body responsible for standard setting, to confirm that it agrees that standard setting is not required, could act as an additional check that the explanatory material does not add or change requirements in the standards. It may provide stakeholders with greater confidence that the standards provide an adequate basis, because the board would act as an independent check on the process, and may enhance the perception that agenda decisions are important and need to be applied when applicable. The staff think that both increasing the Interpretations Committee voting requirements and involving the board is unnecessary. Once the board is involved, we see little additional benefit in requiring a supermajority vote of the Interpretations Committee. However, it is important that the board's involvement should neither undermine the Interpretations Committee or its process. With this in mind, we propose that the board's formal involvement should take place following completion of the Interpretations Committee's process and at the board meeting immediately following the Interpretation Committee's finalisation of an agenda decision. We also think it should take the form of not objecting to the publication of the agenda decision, with the specifics of that explained in paragraph 32b of agenda paper 2, with it proposed that the board involvement should be that an agenda decision is published if no more than three board members object. I refer you to question 3 in agenda paper 2, which I believe is on page 2. I hand it over.
Questions, comments?
This is Guillermo. I like the staff's proposal of having the board intervene in the process in the form of not objecting. I think that this is, even though it will take some time, it seems that it's not going to be that much, and I think it strengthens the process. The one thing that I'm not sure I agree with is the fact that we shouldn't do both. The board's adding the board to the process, but also having the supermajority. And by supermajority, we're saying one more vote. We're not saying two-thirds or something like that. So I would like to know the rest of the committee's views, but I would say that I might be inclined to do both.
Okay. Any other thoughts on that?
On that specific point or on the...
Now, that's the discrete point. I don't know if...
My response to what Guillermo is saying would be would be taken into consideration how the board is going to actually opine on... Is everyone asked to actually opine on the... agenda decision, or is it just a matter of leaving them the option to...
No, I think there will be at the next board meeting, the way I understand the proposal,
yeah,
is I that at the next board meeting, the members of the board will be specifically asked whether they object to the agenda decision that has been put before them.
So there'll be
there will have to be a yes or no for
yes.
every moment.
Yes.
So there'll be a public, there'll be a paper tabled for the board.
Public meeting,
and a
formal
public discussion,
question.
And a public vote.
Yeah.
I mean, Guillermo, I'll tell you why I think this procedure is the right one. The Constitution vests certain responsibilities in the Interpretations Committee, and I think we have to be careful not to undercut them, as the paper says. On the other hand, and it's not at all inconsistent with the Constitution, the board is the ultimate authority on what the standards are, and whether they are what our various stakeholders should live by. And there are three separate questions around agenda decisions that I think rest properly, can be viewed as resting properly with the board, and this due process handbook proposal will make it clear that that's the case. One is, does the standard need to be amended? That's the primary purpose of an agenda decision. By asking the board whether they agree with that or whether they object to that, we're getting their decision on whether the standard needs to be amended, or their agreement that it doesn't need to be amended. Secondly, does the agenda decision change an existing standard? And again, because the board is the ultimate keeper of the standards, if you will, and the ultimate arbiter of the standards, it should ultimately be for the board to determine whether or not an agenda decision changes the requirements of the standard. Asking the board, do they object, takes care of that. Thirdly, we are now, if we accept the first set of revisions we talked about, we are in black and white saying, in order to comply with the standards, you have to comply with the agenda decision. And it is consistent with that approach to ask the board to be the ultimate arbiter of, do you object to what the IFRIC has said? And so it seems to me, if you think about the agenda decision as carrying out those particular important functions, it makes perfect sense for the board to be the person that says, that's the case. On the second point of Guillermo's point, I think there's nothing intrinsic about a simple majority versus a simple majority plus one that defines whether IFRIC is doing the right thing or not. While I know that the letters say one of the things they have a concern about is the simple majority, I think that the totality of those letters, I'm not putting words in the letter writer's mouths, but the totality of those letters suggests that there is a concern about due process that's deeper than just the simple majority. I think what we're proposing deals, frankly, with the substance of what they're raising than a supermajority would. And so that's why I get to where we are.
The reason why I'm saying this, and I might be wrong about this, but to my mind, the board might be more inclined towards not opening up the standards. So if there's this type of discussion, and I take that from the letters that we received, if there's such a heated or divided discussion as to whether there needs to be an amendment or the agenda decision is the right way to go, it seems to me that we need to be absolutely sure and certain that the standard is clear. And the supermajority gives me a bit more comfort that would be the case. And that's why I think that supermajority might be a good mechanism for this.
Yeah, I hear you, Guillermo, but I would say if we've got a process where objection from four out of 13 board members is sufficient to, in effect, re-trigger that question, that should give the community a very high level of comfort that we're getting to the right answer.
And if I may add, if you just look at the latest case we just looked at, so suppose there had that been that requirement of the majority of two, then I am pretty sure it would have gone to the board, and the board would have, have concluded that is the fact that it has not been deemed an agenda decision is the wrong decision, and we would have had to start
all over again,
and would be highly demotivating, I believe, for the interpretations committee. So a double lock can also lead to a stalemate and a very unpleasant procedure.
Yeah, and the other question is, do you need the one more or two more or three more to have a supermajority?
It's an extraordinary pressure on the system.
Yeah.
And on committee members.
Yeah.
Can I ask, I agree with the proposed approach of not objecting to the publication by the board. And I was looking at this threshold. I think that at the end of the day, we have to be pretty pragmatic about it. We can't just sort of say not objecting and not go on to say what constitutes not objecting. So I'm okay with, you know, a formula, but 3 out of 14, and is there any precedent of this type of ratio in anything else that the board does?
Yes.
So that ratio essentially mirrors when the board is asked whether it objects to the publication of a draft IFRIC interpretation. So that's where we got that from, and we've been deliberate to mirror that, so not to create added complexity in the due process.
Okay, thank you. And could somebody explain 3 over 14 kind of doesn't divide, you know, with simple arithmetic. Was there any rationale behind that ratio?
So it would actually be if 4 object, Teresa. So specifically, it's 4. If 4 board members were to object, then it doesn't get published, and then the board would be there to determine what happens next. But it's essentially, like I say, mirroring the process we have for the draft IFRIC interpretation.
But 4 is a third of the.
Yeah. Yes.
The mathematics, Teresa, center around 1/3.
Ah, it's intended to be 1/3. Is that right?
That's correct.
I see. Okay. Right. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else on this? Okay, Sam?
Thanks, Alan. So now I'll look at board agenda decisions. The exposure draft proposed giving the board the ability to publish agenda decisions. The proposal was not intended to supplant the interpretation committee process, and that the board was expected to publish agenda decisions only in rare circumstances. Most respondents disagreed with the proposal. Respondents thought that it would add unnecessary complexity, saying the board already had sufficient tools to respond to questions. The staff acknowledged these concerns about complexity, and given the board was expected to publish agenda decisions only on rare occasions, the cost of that additional complexity appears not to outweigh the potential benefits. The staff recommend not proceeding with the proposal to give the board the ability to publish its own agenda decisions. Do the DPOC agree with our proposal?
Okay. Comments, questions? I think this is a fairly clear decision in light of sort of the, I don't want to say marginal, but it would not be an earth-shaking change to give the board this power. And I think it's fair to say that to the extent there was a high degree of uniformity in the comments, it was certainly most around this. So I know why we proposed it. I think it was the right thing to do, but I'm also very comfortable with saying we're not going to proceed with it. And does the committee have any other views?
No, none this end.
Okay. Anyone?
Same here.
Okay. Sam, the last point.
Yeah. And yeah. So finally, I'd like to discuss the question of re-exposure. Now, we think that all the recommendations made in Agenda Paper 2 and the other recommendations previously directly respond to the concerns raised in the responses to the proposed amendments to the handbook. The staff think that specifically that the recommendation for board involvement in publishing an agenda decision addresses stakeholders' suggestions to enhance the due process relating to publishing an agenda decision, but it does differ from the specific enhancements that were suggested by stakeholders. The staff think that we are unlikely to receive any fundamentally new information if the document were to be re-exposed, and that this is compatible with the re-exposure criteria set out in the paper. Also, it should be noted that given recent correspondence received, it is clear that it would be beneficial to enhance the due process associated with the agenda decisions as soon as possible. So I'll hand it over for discussion on that, Alan.
Yeah, and I'd merely point out one thing, which is that under the committee does, there is nothing in the due process handbook that specifically discusses re-exposure of revisions to the handbook by the committee. That doesn't surprise me particularly. But there is criteria which Sam alludes to and which the paper alludes to in terms of the criteria for re-exposure by the board. And I think importantly, it is a two-prong test. It's the more commonly considered prong in the vernacular is it something that was previously exposed? But there is a very important second prong, which is, if we were to re-expose, what is the likelihood that we would get new information that would make our ultimate deliberations better? And I think particularly on the second prong, given the comment that we have already received, and given that there is a significant downside to taking more time, and we have been, since the beginning of this process, committed as a committee to do this as expeditiously as we can. And every time there's been a thought about, well, let's take another month or two, the answer quite properly has been, let's get on with it. I think in the light of those two criteria, the right answer here is, frankly, let's get on with it and adopt the proposals without re-exposure. But that is a decision that the committee has to take. But that's the staff's recommendation, and I certainly am supportive of it.
Can you clarify if the conditions set in Article 51 are met? There's no plan to re-expose, or?
There's no plan to re-expose.
Okay. And what's the logic for that? Article 51 says that there are two tests in the handbook.
Right.
If the tests are met.
If both prongs
yes.
are.
Or one of them is met.
That's not enough to re-expose.
And the two?
Oh, both are met.
Yes.
Then the board would normally re-expose.
Right. So that would apply to agenda decisions.
We have no other guidance, and so therefore,
that section relates to agenda decisions.
Section relates to board standards.
This is what the board uses.
This is what the board uses. There is nothing in the handbook that talks about what the committee should use. So we are taking that by analogy, if you will.
Okay. So the handbook will say that if those two conditions are met,
the board would have to re-expose a standard.
We're not proposing to put it into the handbook per se, right? You're just proposing.
No, we're not proposing to add that to the handbook for the committee. We're just proposing to follow it.
Okay.
In this case.
Okay. And what about if those tests are met in the context of an agenda discussion?
You're writing on a clean sheet of paper. We don't have any specific rules in the hand.
So I think, Michelle, if I understand your question, might link back, and by the way, a bit to Therese's comments earlier, I'll sort of come back to it. So I think you're asking maybe, is there a re-exposure or is there a re-exposure criteria in terms of publishing an agenda?
Right.
Yeah. So I think there is, I think that what's in the handbook specifically talks about standard setting. However, what I can tell you in practice, like you are doing now as a DP, I think we almost apply that criteria in the context of publishing an agenda decision. So for example, and it's one of the reasons that in Appendix A to this paper, you'll see that sentence added in what is in paragraph 8.2b. And I can only tell you how practice it happens, because I remember in a particular question we had, to do with cash flow hedge countries, but and we initially just included Secretary Belief in the tentative agenda decision. We got a lot of comments back that we should expand the scope of what we talked about, which we did, and going through the next process because the amount of detail in the tentative agenda decision had changed quite substantively. As a committee, we decided to re-expose and therefore, you know, issue another tentative agenda decision, which is what that is to get. So I think without it being said, the interpretations committee actually applies that.
Okay, so why not making that?
It is, in fact, what we do.
This is what you do.
To say that the interpretations committee would follow the same process.
Yeah.
I think that's an addition we can make, and I'm fine with that. Any other comments? Taking silence as assent. Let me call the collective question here, I think, which is, before I do that, there is in the paper in Appendix B, which discusses one by one the various comments that have been received and what the staff has proposed to have done. I don't think that's new information for the committee. That was at least one of the earlier drafts that we circulated and was at least briefly discussed on an earlier call. I don't propose to discuss it again. It's not about the agenda decision point that we've been talking about. And so I would basically call the question with the drafting tweaks that I think are left to be made. And again, we would take drafting suggestions, and with Michelle's proposal that we add to the handbook a reference to agenda decisions following a re-exposure process that is similar to that which the board currently follows as provided in the handbook. Does the committee agree with the recommendations in the paper as Sam has described them, the second paper that we've been discussing for the last hour? That would, if it's approved, I think complete the committee's substantive deliberations on the revisions, and I think our next step would be to seek to finalize the revisions for the committee's deliberations at the Brussels meeting in February, and then to proceed with finalization thereafter. That would be the timeline. But today's question is, again, I guess, since we're on the phone and I can't see everybody, if anyone objects to our proceeding with that plan of approving in substance what we've been talking about this morning, please speak up, and otherwise we will view everybody as saying aye. I hear all ayes. Listen, this has been this has required some considerable effort by this committee. I think as trustees, all of you have really done a thorough and careful job and spent a lot of time on it. I thank you. We'll continue the process in Brussels, but I think the heaviest lifting, I think, has been done. And I want to thank the board and Sue as the head of the committee and all the staff for having been indispensable in our getting to this point. So if there's anything else from the board, the microphone is open for a few more seconds, and then I think we will adjourn.
Nothing from France except a Merry Christmas to all.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Okay, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anna. Thanks.
Thanks, Sheila. Lovely.
My job, Michelle. Thank you.
No, thank you.